Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast with bar charts you can believe in. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
Now, Steve, I'm a big fan of arbitrary milestones, so I'm particularly excited that this is our 200th episode.
Oh, wow.
Now, if we assume that each episode averages about 30 minutes, that equates to at least 100 hours of us mostly talking about Brexit, which is 4+ days worth, so almost double the length of the entire series of The Wire, and almost as much as The West Wing.
And it's probably about twice the amount of time spent discussing Brexit in the Cabinet as well.
And it's also the first time we've recorded since the official general election campaign started. What we're going to try and do in this one is take as much of a step back from the hurly-burly as far as we can, just to see what light's been shed on some of the big themes we've talked about over the past 2.5 years. So we'll talk about populism, we'll talk about electoral reform, of course. Firstly, though, inevitably, we're going to talk about Brexit. Said Steve, we'll begin with the wider issue of the UK's place in Europe. Now, ostensibly, we're having this election because we need to sort out Brexit or get Brexit done or stop Brexit, depending on which colour your tribe is. How big an issue has Europe been in this election?
Well, so far, not very really, at least when it comes to like the media air war. Pretty much everything that's kind of been hailed as policies which would have been a part of any other general election. It's your standard kind of retail talking point. Oh, you can't trust Labour on the economy. They're going to spend all of this money that they don't have. All of that kind of standard stuff. Nothing too different compared to 2017, to be honest with you. Yeah, there's just not been a lot of actual kind of major messaging going out, seemingly, on Brexit itself.
Considering that we're having this election, as we've said a couple of times, because Boris Johnson got a Brexit deal, and he wants to get it passed through Parliament. And the metaphor that he uses is that there's an oven-ready deal that just needs to be put in the microwave. Now, as someone who gets slightly irritated by mixed metaphors, an oven-ready deal you put in the microwave, I have a number of issues with. If the whole point is you've made something to then put in the oven, that's then a crispening up process, isn't it? If it's like a lasagna or a fish pie, you put that in the oven to crispen it up. If you're going to put that in the microwave, it wouldn't have the same effect. It would go soggy.
I mean, to be honest, I feel like that's quite an apt metaphor for Brexit.
But also, if it's an oven-ready deal in a Pyrex pot that you would put in the oven, that won't fit in the microwave anyway.
So in this metaphor, what is the Pyrex pot?
Well, presumably...
The DUP? Is the DUP the Pyrex pot?
Or is it the renegotiation? I mean, maybe it's Tim Barrow. Maybe he's the Pyrex pot in this analogy. It strikes me that Boris Johnson hasn't done a lot of home cooking. Certainly from the footage that's come out over the past 2 days, he doesn't do a lot of mopping. So maybe we should be more forgiving of his home spun metaphors about his deal. There hasn't been a lot of scrutiny of it at all, really. No. Keir Starmer did some very forensic stuff in Parliament. Obviously, on the podcast, we have a no alcohol rule, unless we're talking about Donald Trump. But Johnson gave a very good reason why we have no alcohol rules on the podcast when he was tired and emotional, one could say, and gave some well lubricated remarks to Irish business. I think it was an Irish business forum, wasn't it?
Something
Northern Ireland
like
business
that, yeah.
Forum, about his Brexit deal. And we'd said on the last time we were here, when the election campaign, we knew there was going to be an election, that Boris Johnson didn't seem to know the details of his deal. And again said there was going to be no extra paperwork, no checks, which just isn't true, is it?
No, it can't be true unless there's some kind of details which just haven't been released in some capacity. But if those sorts of details had been negotiated, then you'd be singing them from the rooftops because you'd have an excellent deal.
Well, and the way it's being sold, and the way that Dominic Raab and Boris Johnson have both said it's an excellent deal for Northern Ireland because it keeps them in a single market and they have free movement, is just
Yeah. It's astounding. The reason we've not had a lot kind of actually said about Brexit so far is because neither the Tories nor Labour really want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. Labour don't want to talk about it because obviously that would then put a spotlight on their positioning, which would then...
I think our positioning is very clear, Steve. Do I have to explain it again? Look, we'll negotiate a new deal and we'll have a referendum on that and it'll be sorted.
Yeah, absolutely. But that then would open up the charges of like being too late to the party, which the Lib Dems can then run with and all of that sort of stuff. So Labour don't want to talk about it. The Tories equally don't want to talk about it because even though they've got a renegotiated deal, the reality is if somebody does start looking at it forensically, if people do start paying attention to the details of it, then people are going to find things that they don't like in it.
What, like it breaks the union?
Yeah. And the media's quite happy to play ball with that simply because we've been talking about Brexit for so goddamn long that they just want to talk about something else. Like, when people do start talking about the state of the NHS or broadband infrastructure or police officer numbers or whatever it might be, people are just going, thank God, this is something new and different and more interesting compared to everything else that we've been harping on about for the past 2.5 years.
Well, and this is the logic of the Labour campaign, isn't it? The logic of the Labour campaign is, essentially, we have the same Brexit policy that the Lib Dems had 2 years ago. Yep. Hello, Mark, by the way. We also then want to try and say, look, you might not think that our policy on Brexit came early enough to the party for you guys. Sorry about that. But we have this big transformative agenda and we're going to fix everything that's wrong with the country and make it big and shiny. And isn't that nice? That's essentially the Labour campaign, I think. Addendum to that, maybe the only thing is, again, this link of, again, Labour's trying to do with Johnson, Farage and Trump, which I think is having a bit of a cut through. And so this idea that actually if Britain isn't with Europe, then it is with Trump's America. There is a little bit of talk on that, but it's not... you could use that and pivot to a more explicitly pro-European position.
Yeah, absolutely, you could. But equally, I think the Labour leadership is still stuck in this in this mindset that somehow Labour voters are split between being Remain and Leave and that there's a roughly even distribution of them when that's not the case at all. Like, there's been analysis done that even in, like, Labour seats where people which voted Leave, the vast majority of the Labour voters in those seats did not vote Leave, they voted to Remain.
But they're the kind of voters that Boris Johnson's hoping to win in this red wall, which apparently it's called now, which really scares me because I remember Hillary Clinton had a blue wall, which was impenetrable, except it wasn't.
Yeah.
But there's a kind of red wall of northern seats, isn't there, in the North Midlands that Johnson's, I think, hoping to get his majority in through Labour Leave voters. And I'm sceptical at the moment. There's still a lot of tribal suspicion of the Tory party, I think, among those voters still. And also, Brexit isn't the biggest issue with those voters, mm-hmm. I think.
Former Labour voters, current Labour voters, whatever, whether they be Leave or Remain, tend to be people who are much more concerned about the states of local infrastructure, school funding, all of those sorts of things. Whilst the Tories voters, due to them largely speaking being wealthier or pensioners, aren't as fussed about those things because they're not as reliant on them or they're not necessarily seeing it in the same kind of way. So for them, they have that. It's like a Maslow's hierarchy of needs type thing. They're absolutely fine. They're at that level where it's just like they've gotten everything other than self-actualization. And for them, that's an independent Britain away from Europe. Whilst everybody else is going, well, that might actually be nice. Some people think that. But actually, school's not got enough funding, the hospital's being threatened with closures, like the police numbers have been cut and crime's up in our area. Things that are much more relevant to their day-to-day lives than Brexit ever will be.
And I think that moves us nicely on, actually, to the second big thing that we can talk about of populism. One of the big subplots of this election so far has been how many Brexit Party MPs are going to stand in the election. Nigel Farage is allowed to be quite close with Boris Johnson in a way that David Cameron just would not have allowed. Mm-hmm. So when we started this, incredibly, David Cameron was Prime Minister when we started this podcast, which feels an eon ago.
It does feel like a lifetime, doesn't it?
And Cameron, his whole leadership shtick was disassociating himself with what he called, you know, the fruitcakes closet racists of UKIP. And yet the Tory strategy, I think, essentially is to pally up with Nigel Farage. And so we have a situation where the Brexit Party is not standing in any seat that the Tories won in 2017. So not standing in about 317 seats. How big an impact do you reckon that'll have?
This is one of those interesting little moves. I mean, my main takeaway is this is how this probably actually screws over the Brexit Party as a party in any meaningful way, just because effectively you've had that there are reports and people like Brexit Party candidates basically spending like £100 just to have the chance to be interviewed to become an MP, spending their own money to have, in effect, you know, a campaigning infrastructure because the Brexit Party's not paying for it. People who are clearly quite wealthy because they can afford to do this.
Hiring... Well, you assume that. We don't know that.
It's true.
They could spend their life savings on it, you know, if they want to be in Parliament.
It's true. It is possible. But people spending, you know, tens of thousands of pounds hiring campaigners and campaign organisers and things out of their own profit, out of their own pockets, only for Nigel Farage, on a whim, no, you know, talking to the actual Brexit Party or the candidates themselves or anything like that, just outright saying on his own decision, because he is the leader and there are no democratic infrastructures in the Brexit Party at all, it seems. Well, half of the seats we're just not going to stand anymore. Okay, cool. Well, that's going to royally annoy an awful lot of people, including your own activists. So I think medium to long term, this probably actually ends up killing the Brexit Party as an actual force. In terms of the results on this election, though, I'm honestly not sure. And I know it's not necessarily au fait these days to admit you don't know the answer to something. I feel so much has been made about the Brexit Party vote, but equally, it's basically just the UKIP vote from last time. The UKIP vote probably does lean more towards being Tory than Labour in a lot of areas. Is it enough to actually get them get through that red wall? Maybe. I'm not convinced by it. You might have a couple of breakthroughs, but from the Conservatives' perspective, that's then going to be kind of counterbalanced by the fact that there are going to be other seats where they're going to lose down south.
I think in terms of Tory seats that they keep, I think it means that the Tories have a higher ceiling of seats. So it consolidates what they got in 2017, I would have thought, and means they might not lose as many. However, does it help them win over seats in that red wall? Presumably not, because actually they're still standing in those seats for the most part. I mainly know about West Midlands seats. So in Birmingham Northfield, which is, I think, the Tories' second target seat nationally, there is not only a Brexit Party candidate, there is a UKIP candidate. So
what?
An embarrassment of riches.
Oh, wow.
For the good people of Northfield to choose. And again, they're standing in Birmingham Erlington as well, which, again, I said a door knocking earlier today, that was, I think, about 63% leave. So again, most of the evidence suggests that will probably benefit Labour more than the Tories. Possibly it is a home for Labour leavers to go to who think the Tory brand's still too toxic for them. But generally, Matt Singh on the Number Crunch of Politics has been quite good in this. Brexit Party votes, generally if they're standing, it hits the Tories more. Yeah. So it might mean the Tories, it's harder for them to take other seats. But having said that, other key target seats in the West Midlands, so there's one held by Ian Austin, who we'll talk about in a second. He won that by 22 votes. Nigel Farage was meant to go to Dudley on Friday and speak at a rally, which was abruptly cancelled because Rupert Lowe, ex-chairman of Southampton Football Club, now Brexit Party MEP, stood down right at the last minute. so that they couldn't put up a candidate for the Brexit Party in Dudley North.
Hmm.
Which you'd have thought almost certainly makes it much, much, much harder for Labour to hold on to that seat.
You would have thought.
Walsall North is an interesting one as well. So Labour held that in 2015 when UKIP stood. They then lost it to Eddie Hughes by 2,500 votes in 2017 when UKIP didn't stand. And again, I believe I'm right in saying that the Brexit Party aren't standing in Walsall North this time. That decision, again, makes it, I would say, harder for Labour to retake that seat. Not impossible, but much more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a story of a Brexit Party candidate who only realised that he wasn't going to be a candidate when he was manning a street stall, and a member of the public comes up to him at a street stall and says, "Oh, by the way, mate, you're not standing, are you? Because Farage just made this announcement." So it really handled very shoddily.
Yeah, absolutely.
One of the big lessons from 2017 was the Tory message on austerity was pretty naff, and Theresa May saying there's no magic money tree. And austerity, as if there was a clearer message that austerity was a political choice.
Suddenly they found the magic money tree, listeners.
It makes me really quite frustrated, because for 9 years we have been told that there is no way that the government can invest in these services.
Yeah, we were literally told that there is no alternative.
And it turns out, actually, when the Tories need to win an election, suddenly there is money for schools, for hospitals.
And interestingly, there's been some interesting little research which has been done on like some of the spending that has been done previously. So like there's been some funds for like local towns and things which was meant to help revitalise local town economies, that sort of stuff. Guess where all of that money's gone?
London.
No.
Tory marginals. It also frustrates me because we know that austerity, but we know that areas with high levels of austerity had higher levels of Leave vote. And again, it's a frustration with a lot of, especially Lib Dem activists on Twitter, who will quite happily say they want to stop Brexit, but apparently want to blame Jeremy Corbyn for Brexit happening, despite the fact that austerity probably had more of a play in the Brexit vote than Jeremy Corbyn did. And the lack of a Swinson leadership to acknowledge that is immensely frustrating. And just shows, I think, a lack of basic analysis of the situation.
Well, I think that basically boils down to, in effect, people not looking at it from the perspective of what of how a historian might. You know, it's much easier in the current day, in the present, to just allocate blame to something that's right in front of you. People don't like to look back for actual causes, because that actually involves thought and people trying to actually look at their own actions, which people don't like critiquing themselves.
Now, that's why this podcast has been very painful at times over the past 3.5 years.
As a result of that, people don't just sit there and go, well, actually, you know, austerity probably did play a role in the Brexit vote. Well, historic, you know, it probably is going to be viewed like that in some capacity, but people aren't going to look at it like that in the current day.
Now, one final thing on spending is the £1.2 trillion figure. So I suppose, just as Gordon Brown in 2010 didn't want the election defined as being about Tory cuts versus Labour cuts, obviously Tories don't really want to have an election defined as Tory investment against Labour investment, where the Labour investment is bigger. So what they've done is invent a quite fantastical figure of £1.2 trillion, which apparently Labour's going to spend. The way they've calculated this figure is by looking at every single commitment that Labour makes in the 2017 manifesto, every commitment made by a shadow minister since then, every policy passed by Labour Party conference, and every policy paper that the party's put out since then. And if you've got a policy, say like 4-day work week, which was passed at Labour conference, I believe, earlier this year, that's meant to be a phased in thing.
Yeah, I believe it starts off as like a trial areas and things like that. So,
and yet, when it's costed in this, it's assumed it will start straight away.
The OBR, I think for the first time ever, basically has come out and says, yes, we're not actually going to be able to provide any like scrutiny or costings for opposition spending commitments as part of this election, basically because the government's given them a load of figures and they've said, no, this is crap. Like, and as a result of that, they can't go in and because of their role and their remit, they're not allowed to basically take the Labour manifesto when it comes out, do it, give one set of figures and have the government say something else completely different.
Well, the Saj, or as his friends know him, Sajid Javid, he tried to get the civil service to do costings, didn't he? And Mark said what the cabinet secretary said, hell no, yeah. Jog on. Probably in civil service terms.
It's a very brave move, Minister.
It's courageous, in fact. Theo Bertram, actually, who's a former Gordon Brown advisor, wrote an interesting article for The Guardian on this, on these kind of commitments, usually these calculations, certainly when New Labour did them, it was seen as it had a bit more intellectual heft and a bit more of a research heft as well. So you'd do parliamentary questions to try and eke out details of spending commitments and policy, and you'd use official figures. Whereas if you look at the references in the research for the Conservative Research Department one, it just says, in many cases, Conservative research figures available on request. So they're not even trying to put their figures out to scrutiny. Labour spending bombshell is a Tory playbook from time immemorial, just as Labour in this election is running on the NHS. Some things don't change. The other end of populism that we've seen over the past 3 and a bit years is the populism in the Labour Party. So there were a few. We've also had 3 Labour MPs, including Ian Austin, say, don't vote for Labour, vote for Boris Johnson. And also, what we're seeing is a bit of a game-changing move. Tom Watson, deputy leader, we haven't had a podcast since he stood down as well. Certainly, talking amongst Labour activists from a range of different areas, the way that people felt about Tom Watson was it was quite sad, whereas actually people were quite angry at what Ian Austin was saying.
Mm, yeah. I mean, Austin's comments are coming from a completely different kind of place, but fundamentally the thing that is kind of really doing my head in about the whole kind of like Ian Austin standing down and then saying, I cannot in good conscience vote Labour, or proper Labour people should vote for Boris Johnson, is that there's been a lot of media attention given to that comment. Compare and contrast the coverage that got with David Gawke, Ken Clark, Justine Greening,
Bowles.
Nick Bowles, all of these are former senior Conservatives of various shades, basically saying, oh yeah, I can't in my good conscience vote for Boris Johnson. Ian Austin, sure, he was a good local MP, whatever. I've got no knowledge on that front, really. Nobody.
I reckon it's because he used to be a New Labour Gordon Brown press officer. So I think there's, you know, the New Labour machine can still crank it up when it needs to.
Might very well. But essentially, you've got Ian Austin, who's not really anybody prominent at all in the Labour Party, saying that, versus Tory grandees, quite literally in the form of Kenneth Clark, basically saying the exact same thing. And the coverage has been minimal compared to what Ian Austin was given. And it's absolutely astounding.
I mean, I think the other thing with Ian Austin that we should talk about is, especially during an election time when everything can be very heightened, I think one has to think of, okay, what is the best argument against my position?
Yeah.
And I think Ian Austin does articulate that very well. And actually, at times, Boris Johnson articulates an argument against Labour very well. I think Boris Johnson's best argument has been putting forward, well, if we have a Jeremy Corbyn government, there will be 2 referendums. We'll have one on Scottish independence and we'll have one on the EU.
Yeah.
And
we don't get to go back to business as normal. With this, all of this becomes elongated.
And in terms of a population that is often very sick of politics and politicians, I think the argument has good cut through, and also is, do we really want more referendums after the last lot? Whereas the Ian Austin thing, it's a very moral issue on something like anti-Semitism. And I think the thing that frustrates me most, I think, about a lot of the Corbynite left is they assume that if opposition is given to Jeremy Corbyn, they list a lot of Corbyn's policies and go, well, do you disagree with any of those? And forget that actually this isn't the issue that most people have. The issue that most people have is this issue of institutional racism,
a failure of leadership,
and anti-Semitism. And certainly, I feel personally, as someone who has spoken about anti-Semitism in branch meetings, we've talked about it on the podcast, I'm campaigning for a Labour candidate, hashtag stick with Steve, who's spoken out about anti-Semitism in the party. I feel that I've done enough to have a clear conscience and vote Labour with a clear conscience. Ian Austin, as someone who was brought up by, adopted by refugees from Eastern Europe, obviously it's a very big moral red line for him. But say you look at someone like Ruth Smith, who's made a very different moral choice. Luciana Berger made a very different moral choice. There are lots of people who are making their minds up, looking at their consciences and making decisions come what may. My issue with the Ian Austin thing is, if you are worried about prejudice and you're worried about racism, I'm not sure that getting people to vote for Boris Johnson is a solution to the problem that you're setting up. And I don't mean that in terms of whataboutery. It just genuinely doesn't make sense.
No, I it doesn't do anything to actually solve the problem. It very much strikes me of like, well, it's a position of privilege where you can just go, not my problem anymore, I'm going to disassociate from this. But it doesn't actually solve the issue. If everybody if everybody who had an issue with how Labour has handled anti-Semitism left the Labour Party, it's just going to stay exactly the same. Fundamentally, you still need people in there to fight that corner and actually purge it from the system.
But I think it's more people have chosen to, as they would say, stay and fight. Some people have chosen to leave. I think both of those are equally valid moral, equally valid moral choices.
Like, they are equally valid, but from Ian Austin's perspective, he doesn't hold that.
I suppose he's chosen to leave and fight. So that's enough about former MPs who are named after former England cricketers. Let's move on. Niche reference there. Any fans of Lancashire in the 1990s? Let's move on to the electoral system in the British Constitution. Because we haven't talked about the electoral system
yet. The joy on your face as you said that is honestly, twinkle in the eye.
I mean, we did start by thinking about, are referendums a useful way of deciding things? And 3.5 years on, we still haven't quite come to an answer other than
probably not.
My hot take is a second referendum. Well, we have more evidence now to prove our prejudices in a second referendum. We've already talked about the Brexit Party Pact. We haven't talked about the Remain Alliance, or who have rebranded as Unite to Remain. I believe there's 60 seats where people are standing in. And I think it's Plaid and Greens and the Lib Dems have all stood down candidates in various seats to try and unseat Conservatives, or occasionally unseat Labour Remainers like Ben Bradshaw, which is lovely, in Exeter, I believe that is. What's your view on these kind of electoral pacts? So should Labour have tried to stand down candidates, say, in, let's say, take a hypothetical example, should Labour have stood down a candidate in Richmond Park to try and let Sarah Olney beat Zach Goldsmith in return for a Lib Dem standing down in Canterbury to defeat Rosie Duffield?
Potentially, but fundamentally, it basically boils down to what are the arguments that you're trying to make within your campaign. Definitely for the Lib Dems, their entire argument is basically vote for us, we're not the Tories and we're Remainers. We're the people that are actually fighting to stop Brexit. Labour are not a party of Remain. That is their argument, that is their line. For them, maybe that would actually kind of make sense, and by all accounts, apparently they did try and have some conversations with Labour, but they just didn't get anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
For Labour, they don't want this election to be about Brexit. And so from their perspective, are joining any form of alliance, Unite to Remain, whatever you want to call it, makes it about Brexit, which immediately puts scrutiny on their policy, which immediately causes them headaches. So from their perspective, they don't want that. So of course they're not going to get involved with it, which in turn feeds into the Lib Dems narrative as well. So you end up with this one initial move has just led to a load of other things kind of falling in place afterwards, which has resulted in some bizarre things of like Lib Dem candidates standing down in Canterbury because Rosie Duffield is actually a Remainer, but he's now being punished by the party and has been replaced as a candidate by somebody else, even though that's in spirit of the principle of what they're trying to do. And it's an absolute mess in a lot of ways. But nobody seems to actually be willing to answer the basic question of, if the Lib Dems stand down here, where should they stand down for Labour? Or if Labour stands down here, where should the Lib Dems stand down? Like, no one's actually prepared to have that conversation. And to be quite honest, it's redundant. It's not going to happen. So let's move on.
Before we move on, though, just a few more thoughts. So, as we've said before, there's probably one thing that Jeremy Corbyn's wing of the Labour Party has in common with Labour First, who are the kind of uber-moderate wing of the Labour Party, which are they are not interested in proportional representation, although John McDonnell's come out in favour.
Yeah.
But they're not interested in PR, they're not interested in doing deals with other parties. They on the Labour First side, they are tribalist bastards who just want to vote Labour and no one else.
Yeah.
On the left, they're not interested in... They want a transformative socialist government and don't want that watered down by working with bourgeois Lib Dems. Sorry, Mark, not my view, it's theirs. So on that, it was always a little bit of a non-starter, which as someone who, again, would like to see the idea of more parties working together, I kind of would be up for that. But on the other hand, I suppose the Labour narrative is we want to form a majority government. We want Jeremy Corbyn to be the next Prime Minister. And therefore, we have to stand in every seat. The Lib Dem argument, as we said, is very different. Lib Dems are playing to those Remainer Tories. And they need an answer to the Jeremy Corbyn question. And also, and let's be fair, MPs like Luciana Berger have moved to the Lib Dems because of anti-Semitism,
yep,
in the Labour Party that Luciana faced in her CLP. And understandably, probably doesn't want to see the Lib Dems cutting deal with Labour. Problem is, but there's more to politics at the moment than the Leave-Remain question and dividing people into Leavers and Remainers. And when you look at the Unite to Remain alliance, if we just take it at face value, Jo Swinson said that the SNP can't be part of the Unite to Remain alliance because they want to break up the union. And the Lib Dems are not only the party of Remain, they're also the party of the union. However then, you are expecting people who care about the union in Wales
to vote for Plaid.
To vote for Plaid Cymru, which again, okay, maybe Welsh independence isn't around the corner, but
the principle is should still be the same.
If you're going to argue that Labour is not 100% Remain party because possibly there might be a Jeremy Corbyn prime ministership in which Labour campaigns to leave and go out on a Labour deal rather than the Remain, if you can make that contorted argument, but you are unable to consider the Plaid Cymru unionist question, there's a little bit of disingenuousness going on there. Equally, you think about these Remainer Tories, are we expecting Remainer Tories to vote for a Green candidate in some of these seats? Now, admittedly, this is a similar thing. If you'd have had a Labour as part of this alliance, you'd have expected Remainer Tories to vote for a Jeremy Corbyn-led Labour Party. Again...
Is that going to happen?
Again, the problem here is the electoral system.
Yeah.
Anyone who has tweeted about tactical voting, either for or against, should be made to campaign for PR after this election. And as I've said before, my problem is it's being used by a lot of Lib Dems as a wedge issue to bash Labour. Fine, they need those votes. But it should be really being framed in a critique of the electoral system. And it's not being.
The alliance itself in some ways is quite heavily flawed, as you've suggested, because people aren't just voting on the Remain and Leave lines. If they were, then let's be honest, it would be a two horse race between the Tories as the party of Leave and either Labour or Lib Dems as the party of Remain, depending on whatever the view is at that point in time.
The Lib Dems is the party of Remain and Labour is the party of Remain.
Yeah.
Unless you're Len McCluskey.
Basically, what we're not seeing actually in terms of how the polls are moving at the moment, this could change. We're not seeing like a massive kind of spurt off of people towards the Lib Dems or any of the parties necessarily within the Remain alliance. Instead, what we're seeing at the moment seems to be a squeezing of votes of the smaller parties, as is traditionally the case when we get into an election period. Again, could change, but that's what the polls are kind of showing at the moment. My kind of suggests that people are viewing this election in a three-dimensional way rather than a two-dimensional Brexit-related one. There are other issues that they are thinking about and there are other things going on here.
And equally, the issues that have driven the election narrative so far have generally been the NHS and floods.
Yeah.
And the Tories' inadequate response to them, which might drive a bit of the polling too. I mean, we should be honest and say at the moment how the race stands is, if the polls are how they are come December the 12th, Tory majority looks on the cards.
Yeah.
If you were going to look at just uniform national swing. Having said that, a lot of those voters in the European elections, which went to Greens and Lib Dems because of Labour's Brexit policy, such as it was, a lot of those don't know seem to be coming back to Labour. Whether or not it'll be as much as 2017, no one's sure. I think we're always fighting the last war with election campaigns. Yeah, everyone's waiting for that to happen. It hasn't yet.
Yeah, I mean, but equally on that front, if you look at the same kind of period in 2017 compared to where we are now, you know, Labour was massively behind then as well. So it is entirely possible and feasible, and we have like historical kind of evidence that this can happen, that Labour can make up that ground quite substantially. It isn't necessarily the case that the Tories are going to get a giant whopping majority off of where we are in the polls right now, because there's still an awful lot to play for.
No, and interesting constituency polling sort of bearing that out. There are a few caveats to that, though. Obviously, there's caveats with constituency polling generally, but again, the Lib Dem argument, I think, is that the European elections changed the game. The argument is there's been such a big change since 2017 in a lot of these seats that Lib Dems are the best placed challengers. And say in Dominic Raab's seat, Jacob Rees-Mogg's seat, there's been some interesting constituency polling done by Servation in those seats. I think the one in, I want to say it's Wokingham, which is Dominic Raab's seat, I think had Tories 42, Lib Dem 38, Labour 10,
yep,
maybe 15. There's a big Labour vote to squeeze there. You know, think of the bar charts that the people of Wokingham are going to get. They're going to be amazing. And I'm sure, Mark, they will be done to the millimetre. Now, it's very possible there's a good squeeze message that maybe Dominic Raab gets squeaked out there. But even if you look at the figures of Tory 42, Lib Dem 38... that's a 15 or 19% swing to the Lib Dems. I mean, if the Lib Dem strategy, which it seems to be, is essentially rolling three dice and hoping for three sixes in lots of these seats, I worry. Because, yeah, maybe there's a big surge that will sweep Dominic Raab out. And equally, I think this is happening too on the Labour side. People hoping that they can sweep Boris Johnson out or Ian Duncan Smith out. But how likely that is, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a degree of any kind of campaign of trying to balance your aspirations versus your necessities. And sometimes that goes wrong. Case in point, Hillary Clinton's campaign for president, she ended up spending far too much time on her aspirations, ending up in places like Arizona, which was maybe it was going to go blue, maybe it was going to go blue. Oh, it didn't, and we lost the firewall we had because you spent too much time in Arizona rather than in Wisconsin and Michigan.
Mm. I realise that we've spoken for quite a while and we haven't talked about our wonderful policy to nationalise broadband, partly because I have no opinion on the matter. But anyway, we'll have to talk about our transformative economic agenda
some other time.
We have other podcasts about non-election related issues. We're going to have a podcast with a friend of ours at the University of Birmingham talking about the strike action that's happening there. We've got another podcast out on cooperatives. We are going to probably have another election related podcast on December the 8th. Now, if you have any questions in the meantime that you'd like us to talk about, do send them in. I'm at Paperback Writer on Twitter.
I'm at Acoustic Radical.
At No Champagne Pod is our official Twitter handle. We have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. And our website is notenoughchampagne.com. James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter at James Cram. And Dave Depp is responsible for our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. Happy canvassing.